And we're working our way through the book of Romans on Sunday nights. We've been away from it for a wee bit with different events, but tonight we're starting chapter 3. Paul's whole point in the first two chapters and continuing into this one, Paul's whole point is to spell out as clearly as he knows how. He's a bit like a pit bull when, you know, latched onto a bone that he just won't let go of this. His whole point is that Jew and Gentile, the person who's received the special revelation from God of all the Old Testament scriptures, the prophets, the sacrificial system, the Gentile or the Greek, depending on your translation, but he doesn't literally mean people from Greece. He means people outside of the Jewish faith, those who haven't been gifted with the same kind of revelation, haven't been given the scriptures, a lot of people who haven't heard, haven't known. His whole point is that both groups, the person with the Bible, the person without the Bible, the person with revelation, the person with just general revelation through nature and through conscience, but that everyone stands guilty before God, that all are equally sinful, and that all equally need a Redeemer. That's his point. Today we pick it up at chapter 3, verse 1. Probably one of the most tricky passages in the whole book of Romans. I was tempted just to skip over this and go into the last part of the chapter. But he does have some really important things to say here. And so now is the time to be awake. All right? You with me? Okay. Romans 3, verse 1. And you'll see as this continues, it's a very densely packed argument. And you read sentences and you think, now what does he mean by that? Then what advantage has the Jew? Now, let me just say before we get rolling that if you remember what Paul said in chapter 2, we just studied chapter 2, and if you go through verses, say, 25 to 29, where basically Paul says, you know, circumcision itself doesn't accomplish anything. That's what Paul basically said. I mean, as a sign of faith and entering into covenant with God, it had merit. Recognizing what God was doing, getting into the stream of what God was going to do through the giving of the law, the prophets, the sacrifices, the coming of Christ, the reaching of the world through Christ. As one bought into that and said, yes, I'm in, then circumcision had meaning. But if it was used just as a way of saying, I'm circumcised, therefore I'm in the kingdom and I'm immune to judgment, then Paul says, it's ridiculous. Circumcision doesn't accomplish that. Now, for us, that's not so hard to swallow, but you can imagine a Jew, a devout Jew, who hears Paul say, you know, if the uncircumcised, the Gentile, if he puts his trust in God and walks in God's ways, then he's just like you. We can't even imagine today what this raised in the Jewish mind. Paul, what are you saying about the whole Old Testament? What are you saying about the giving of the Old Covenant? What are you saying about all of the blessings that God, I mean, look at this long history of how he worked through the Jewish people. And so it's because Paul anticipates that he starts off asking the question that he knows is on everyone's mind. So what's the advantage in being a Jew? What's the point? Or what value? What is the value of circumcision? Much in every way. To begin with, Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. What if some were unfaithful? Does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. But if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Paul's dealing with arguments now that'll arise. If our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, what shall we say? That God is unrighteous to inflict wrath on us? I speak in a human way. By no means. For then how could God judge the world? We'll talk about those verses. Don't panic. 7. But if through my lie God's truth abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? And why not do evil that good may come, as some people slanderously charge us with saying? Their condemnation is just. What then? Are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. Now that's strange. Look back at verse 1. Then what advantage has the Jew? Or what is the value of circumcision? Much in every way. Okay, now he says, verse 9, are we Jews any better off? No, not at all. You feel like saying, okay, Paul, which is it? Make up your mind here. For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands. No one seeks God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. All these now are Old Testament quotes, okay? They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. That's quite a list that Paul mounts there. Now Paul speaks. Now we know that whatever the law says, and he's just given all these quotes showing their sinfulness, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped, and the whole world may be held accountable to God. Then this is an important verse, summary verse. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes the knowledge of sin. As you can see, that's not the kind of passage people get up and quote all sorts of verses as their favorite text. Here's my life verse, Pastor Don. It's right out of this passage. I've never heard that. And yet there's something here, I think, that the Holy Spirit wants us to digest and get our minds around. I've tried to put, 5 points. What was the purpose and the blessing of God's calling of the Jewish people? That's where Paul starts in verse 1, so let's start there as we unravel this tangled sort of a passage. What advantage, then, has the Jew? Or what is the value of circumcision? Much in every way. To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God. It's interesting. We know that Paul never moves beyond this. Like, he never actually moves beyond just listing one blessing, though he intended to. You can tell he meant to because of the way he says, well, to begin with, so you know there's a list, only Paul never gets to the list. He just lists this one thing. They were entrusted, first of all, with the oracles of God. They were given not only the general revelation that Paul talked about in Romans 1, 18 and 19, and chapter 2, 1 and 2, the revelation through the greatness of creation, of God's might and power. Not only were they given the revelation of conscience, that moral sense of right and wrong that all people possess but don't live up to, which makes them sinners. But they weren't just given that. He says, you were given, the Jewish people, and Paul himself is a Jew, were given the revelation of God, the oracles of God. You can see in that quote from Deuteronomy 4:8, for what nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today? None. They were absolutely unique. God had done something so special for this people. In revealing in writing this great body, not just the Ten Commandments, but this great body of the law of God, the ways of God, the working of God, that go far beyond anything you could see just in looking at the world of creation. So they were tremendously blessed. Secondly, let's move on to a couple of things Paul doesn't mention in this passage. They had the privilege to give testimony to God's greatness to all the nations of the earth. And I say in the notes that it wasn't God's plan to just bless the Jews exclusively and create a club. God called them out. God committed special revelation of his ways to them so that other nations could look and see and they could learn about God the same way that people learn about Jesus looking at the church today. All sorts of people out there haven't cracked a New Testament open. They don't know what it says. They don't know the Sermon on the Mount. They might be able to pick a phrase out of it or two, something from the Lord's Prayer. But they can look at the church, hopefully, because we're supposed to be the body of Christ in this world. Jesus is gone now. He's not physically present. How do people see what Jesus is like? Well, the stunning truth is that when God saved you, when God saved me, the reason he did it was to make a billboard for his grace so that people would see what Jesus is like. If they never opened the Bible, they'd look and they'd see, what's with those people at Cedar View? Wow, are they ever different? Now, the Jew missed this. The reason God called him wasn't just to create a people. It was to create a people, but that wasn't the end. That was the means to the end. And what God wanted to do in calling out this people, God wanted to be a testimony to the nations. In several ways, of course, in his mercy and in his grace, and also in the way he would judge his own people. Brutally at times. And people would see that God is holy. And people would see that God is separate, different from the way ordinary people do things. People would see he was merciful because everyone knew that God didn't choose his people because they were the best and the mightiest and the biggest. The Bible says, no, you were the least. It was just my mercy. So people would watch. They would see. They would see what God was like. They would look at Israel and say, God is afoot. He is up to something in this world. Third, it was through Jewish flesh that the Messiah of all people would be born. That's why you have Matthew 1, 16 and 17 in the notes when it works through the genealogies. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David, and he goes on with the stats. This is what the Jews missed and to a large degree still miss. Paul says it's like there's a veil over their eyes. They don't see it. One day it's going to be revealed more clearly to them. Here was the Jew taking circumcision, taking all of those signs of being covenant people and making them the standards of righteousness with God, when all those things were designed, in God's mind, all those things were designed to point people away from human works to the coming of Christ. God established the Jewish religion to magnify grace in Jesus one day. Far from establishing a system of righteousness where people would be saved by keeping the law, which is what they commonly believed, and it's the argument Paul is trying to demolish, far from that, what God was doing was to set this people apart, set them apart in all sorts of weird ways. I mean, you see all sorts of laws that were involved in separating the Jewish community from the nations around them. And what God was trying to do was to keep his people distinct, separate, because it was through this people and the genealogy, as you trace it, that Jesus would come. That's why a lot of those laws that separated the Jews from all the nations around them, fabrics they could wear, garments they could wear, things they could eat, what was done was to make them a distinct people so that it would be traceable to see it was through them that Jesus came. Now that Jesus has come, Paul says, all that stuff's obsolete. That's the very word Paul uses in the book of Hebrews. It's obsolete. It doesn't mean it was worthless. He means it served its purpose. It maintained that line, that witness to Christ. But the whole purpose of it wasn't to establish a legalistic religion. The whole purpose of it was to shine the light on Jesus. So Paul asked the question, what advantage? Well, lots of advantages. Later on, he asked the same questions. Are Jews better off in verse 9? No, not at all. What he means is lots of advantages. The great things God was doing through this people, but no better off in terms of you can't be saved because you're circumcised. You can't be saved because you keep the law. You're not going to be saved by dietary regulations. You're no different from anybody else. You have to be saved through Christ. Y'all follow that? Okay. Point number two. God uses his own people. Sorry, Paul uses his own people, talking about the Jews, to prove that God is faithful to judge sin in all people. Romans 3:3-4, these kind of confusing words, we'll just look at them for a minute. What if some were unfaithful? Talking about the Jewish people. They weren't all godly. They didn't all keep the covenant faithfully. Does their faithlessness nullify the faithfulness of God? By no means. Let God be true, though everyone were a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. So what Paul wants to say here is that there is no Jewish covenant that automatically insulates people, and he's thinking now about circumcision in particular. That's what he's been writing about, and we'll come back to again. There is no sign of Jewish covenant that by itself means God won't judge their sin. In other words, whether you're circumcised, whether you're one of God's chosen people or not, if you're not faithful to God, if you disobey God, if you sin, God's character doesn't change. He will judge sin whether you're circumcised or uncircumcised. He said you're going to see that. It will be displayed. God's justice and glory will be magnified in the way he will judge his own people, the Jews, when they fall into disobedience and sin. He's just summing up the point he made back in Romans 2:25. For circumcision indeed is of value if you obey the law. But if you break the law, see, he's still demolishing this whole concept that if I can just keep the law, I can earn God's favor. If you break the law, your circumcision becomes uncircumcision. You're just like anybody else. That's what Paul's saying. You're just like anybody else. So circumcision was viewed, I'm just reading this point, circumcision was viewed as implying God's unqualified protection from his wrath against sin. And that is why in chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, Paul makes the point that God's faithfulness to himself requires him to be consistently contrary to sin. In fact, the greater the blessing, the greater the judgment for abusing that blessing. Amos chapter 3, verse 2. You only have I known of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for all your iniquities. You'd think it would be the opposite way, but it isn't so. It isn't so. Okay, flip the page over. Now, that's very hard for them to swallow, that God would maintain the same kind of wrath against sin to the Jew, the circumcised Jew, as to the pagan, the Gentile, the one outside the covenant. How could that be? And what Paul does here is genius. He says, I'm going to prove it to you. And so that's when he starts talking about David. That quote, so that you may be justified in your words and blameless in your judgment. Romans 3:4. That's lifted right out of David's words in Psalm 51:4, where he says, against you and you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you may be justified in your words and blameless in your judgment. Now, just forget about your notes just for a sec. We know the story of David and what he did. David commits adultery with Bathsheba. It's a terrible sin. He has Bathsheba's husband killed. Adultery, murder. The result of this is David's son, later on, is going to die. David is God's anointed. David, all these people would know from the Hebrew scriptures, David is the man after God's own heart. David is called. He's the anointed king of Israel. And yet Paul, in speaking to these Jews, he says, now here's what David understood. He goes and he could have been bitter, he could have been angry, all sorts of things could have entered David's heart. But he said, even though David was king, even though he was called, even though he was anointed, the man after God's own heart, a devout Jew, he says, God, he's thinking about the death of his son. And he says, you're absolutely just. You're justified in what you've done. You're righteous in passing that kind of sentence. And so what Paul does in talking to these Jewish people, saying circumcision doesn't protect you from judgment. We're all guilty of sin in the same way. What Paul does is he looks at David in the same way. In a little while, he's going to look at Abraham again. And he's trying to shut them up on this subject. David recognizes that calling, being one of God's chosen, that doesn't provide immunization from God's judgment when we fail and when we break the law. Point number three. The magnifying of God's justice or grace must never be used. This was the title I gave to this study. The magnifying of God's justice or grace must never be used as an excuse to take sin lightly. Here's the argument Paul imagines. These aren't Paul's words, except as he places them in the mouth of someone else, a protagonist. He imagines someone saying this, but if our unrighteousness serves to show the righteousness of God, like David, he sins and it serves to show the justice of God, how God is faithful to himself. And will not lie. He will judge sin. If our sin shows the righteousness of God like that, what shall we say? That God is unrighteous to inflict his wrath on us? How can God judge us if all we're doing is making him look righteous and good? By no means. For then, how could God judge the world? Another argument he imagines. But if through my lie God's truth abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? And why not do evil that good may come? If it's the same argument. If I can sin, and if God's judgment is revealed, and it just shows his righteousness, and good comes through it, people see the justice of God, the glory of God, the righteousness of God in judging my sin, then all I'm doing is really good. How come God's ticked off with me? And you know, you just realize that people will come up with any argument they can. Let me tell you how it works in everyday life. Some of you know some of the things we've been studying Sunday mornings, especially Joshua chapter 7. And then even this morning, Joshua chapter 8. Chapter 7, you have this horrific judgment of God on Achan and his family. Chapter 8, you have this, it's not just a victory over Ai, it's the annihilation of Ai. The burning of the city to the ground, the hanging of the king, then take his body and put it under a pile of stones so everybody will remember it. There are lots of people who come up, you've heard it. There are lots of people who will say, you know, I don't know you Christians, I don't know how you can worship a God like that. I read my Old Testament and I see the bloodshed and the violence and I see God commanding stuff like that. I will have nothing to do with a God like that. And it's a compelling argument. Except if you've been around the block a few times and you hear as many arguments as I do, because I've had an equal number of people come and they'll say something like this. I don't want to worship your God. I won't follow him. I won't bow down to him. Your God allows bigamy in the Old Testament. Your God doesn't strike people dead even when they commit adultery. Look at the way Jacob lies and David and Solomon have their wives and concubines and slavery and all that thing. And God doesn't do anything. And you feel like, okay, which is it? Are you mad because God's too strict and violent in the Old Testament? Or are you mad because God doesn't annihilate everybody because they're all sinners? And which is it that really bugs you? And the truth of the matter is, if you don't want to bow before God just as he's revealed, then you can argue that he's too strict, and you can argue that he's too lax. Any argument will do if it allows you just to keep from saying, you are my God. And that's what happens. And so Paul recognized it in these people. He could have listed 15 arguments, the kind of arguments people raise. And you'll notice in what I just talked about, it's always the, most commonly at least, the justice of God that people are against. The wrath of God, the judgment of God. I've had more people come up and say, I don't understand, I won't serve a God who's so violent and thirsty for blood as this Old Testament God. Not many people come up and say, I can't imagine why God just doesn't do away with everybody. How could he ever let anybody live if he's absolutely holy? How do any of us get away with anything? And of course, that we don't usually don't argue that way because we're sinners. And so Paul sees this. He sees it in the Jewish religious mind, but it's in all of us. It's in all of us. Just this tendency to find some way of squirming out from under the way we know God is both holy and loving, wrathful, gracious, judging sin, pardoning sinners. The reason it's important to study verses like that, they don't open up easy. They're like some of those nuts you get at Christmas, and you just pop them open, and it's a nice whole thing on the inside, and they're easy to eat. There's other ones, I forget the name of those black wedgie-shaped ones, but boy, you try and crack those things, and they're awfully hard to get into. But they're still good. Some texts are like that. They don't just come apart like a tangerine. You got to work through them. But the important thing to see in this text is the way Paul recognizes the endless capacity people have to justify self just the way they are. What we know for sure is what he points out in verse 6. All these arguments about God aren't going to wash because God's going to judge the whole world. God's going to judge the whole world righteously. Okay, point number 4. In terms of standing under judgment for sin, Jew and Greek, Jew and Gentile, the man with the Bible, the man without, are absolutely equal. He has this, I call it a necklace of Old Testament scriptures. When you get down to verse 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, this horrific list of character traits, sinful traits. And he says all of those quotes come right from the scriptures. They're right from those oracles of God. In verse 2, he said, to the Jewish people were committed the oracles of God. This is the description of human nature right in those scriptures, right in the text that God had given. Lastly, Paul's conclusion on the equal guilt of Jew and Greek before the law of God, 19 and 20. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped, and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes the knowledge of sin. When he talks about the knowledge of sin, he doesn't just mean an academic knowledge, like I know the sun is 93 million miles away from the earth. He doesn't just mean a fact. When he talks about the knowledge of sin, he means what the law does when it comes. The law that God gives through Old Testament revelation to the Jewish people, the law that is placed in every person through conscience in general revelation, he said, what the law of God, in general, what it does is it gives the knowledge of sin in this sense. It makes me understand that I am a sinner. I'm a sinner. It's what was talked about in the Garden of Eden. You eat of that tree, you're going to have this knowledge of good and evil. It doesn't just mean an academic knowledge. It means they will remember both what it was like before the fall, and they will be aware of what their nature is like now after the fall. That kind of knowledge. So the law comes, summing up, the law comes, and it does one of two things. both make me a sinner. One, I don't keep it perfectly. That part's easy. Or, in a religious sense, like the Jew was trying to do with circumcision, I can try and keep the law to the best of my ability. And the parts of it, the outward parts of it that I can keep, will only make me proud of my works and cause me not to rely on Jesus Christ. And that's the other way that we become sinners. Remember, falling into the hole is one form of sin. Trying to climb out without Jesus, that's the other kind of sin. And the law manifests both in religious sin, the sin of pride, relying on the good things that we can do to sort of earn a standing before God. That's sin. And failing to keep it perfectly, that's also sin. That's the work of the law, Paul said. It's just to give the knowledge of sin and to point every person to a Redeemer. What you see when you work through a passage like this is it starts to gradually dawn on us in deeper and fuller ways how this was God's plan all along. His plan all along was just to funnel everything down to Jesus. You never go wrong magnifying Christ because you are cooperating with the members of the Trinity, because the whole plan is, in terms of saving mankind, the whole plan is to put Jesus front and center. It's always been God's plan. It has always been God's plan. And any religion, any religious system, any doctrine that floats around this planet, anywhere, that belittles Jesus, God will judge. God will judge. And when you magnify Jesus, you fulfill the law in the deepest and fullest sense. And that's what we're going to start looking at next week. All right? Amen.